And maybe we'll get through the about two or three chapters tonight. In this 19th chapter, we have the story of some of the history of Egypt. And it's given from the standpoint of how God would intervene and affect the course of history to cause His will to be done in a nation some way or another. As you know, Egypt is traditionally a nation that we think of as being ungodly. It's the nation that held God's people in captive, and God had to force them to let His people go. And you can think of going into Egypt as going into sin, you know. Well, still, Egypt is a nation that God didn't forget. And we'll see how that God interfered with the course of history, even in this nation, to bring about some of the desired things that He wanted. Now, last time we gave a little bit of the rough outline of the history of Egypt, but let's go over this again tonight so we can get the background. Egypt, you know where it's located, of course. It's down south of Palestine, a rather large country, but a desert country that had little or no rain, but yet it was made fruitful by the fact that it had the Nile River. Nile River begins in the southernmost part of Egypt and flows all the way through the country, and it brings the rich silt from the upper Egypt down and deposits it on the lands of the southern Egypt. And about 40, 50 miles before it gets to the Mediterranean Sea, it divides into several branches, and it has a delta there, called a delta because it's shaped like the Greek letter for delta. And as we look at some of the history of Egypt, we find that there was a time when it was divided into 42 districts, or 42 states, or little kingdoms, you might say. The Upper and Lower Egypt also then was the major division geographically, and some even called it Upper, Middle, and Lower Egypt. But it was one of the early seats of civilization. We have, as a matter of fact, this last week in the National Geographic, they have an article about Egypt, which is most interesting. They can show in that article where they go back and take these carvings that are some 5,000 years old, and they show people doing things, and then go down there and take pictures of the people today, and they're doing identically the same things that are in the carvings. Some of the civilization is unchanged for 5,000 years. And in the history of man, that's a mighty long time when we think of man not being here for more than maybe 6,000 years or so. So it was an early seat of civilization. It did have kings. It did have states. There were several major dynasties that ruled in Egypt. And at one time, there was a situation in which there were 12 kings. And these 12 kings were each vying for the superiority, and finally one became superior over the other 12. His name was Psammetichus, and he reigned for 54 years. Then Egypt was captured and ruled by several other countries. There was a period when Nebuchadnezzar captured it and ruled in it, a period in which Cambyses, who was the son of Cyprus of Persia, in 525, he became the ruler over it, or the victor over it. And then in 350 B.C., Alexander the Great ruled over it, as well as over Syria, Assyria, Libya, Palestine. And following Alexander the Great were the Ptolemies, and we read about the Ptolemies when we studied the history in Alexander in Daniel. And under the Ptolemies, Egypt had many, many Jews to go down, and there were Jewish colonies, and many people converted to the Jewish religion during that time. It became a Roman province in 30 B.C., and then in more modern times, in 640 A.D., it was controlled by the Arabs, and in 517 A.D. by the Turks. Now, this history may not mean too much, but as we begin to look at this 19th chapter of Isaiah and see that God was intervening in the things that happened and how He describes this, we can depict some of these things as happening as a result of what God said must happen. So beginning in the 19th chapter of Isaiah, the first verse, the burden of Egypt. As you know, this phrase, the burden, means the prophecy. The prophecy about and the prophecy to. And as it related here in particular to Egypt, it would be a burden because there are many things in here that are going to be hard and difficult for this nation to bear. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt. Now we think of Egypt, you know, as I said earlier, as being a place where God wasn't. A place that was completely free from God because it's looked upon as a godless nation. But God has affairs in Egypt, or he had affairs in Egypt, just as he did the other nations. And I'm persuaded there is no nation that God doesn't have some finger in the affairs of the course of history of that nation. Well, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt. Now, this doesn't mean that the people are going to look up and suddenly see the Lord riding in on a cloud. It's figurative language. But it does mean that the Lord is going to be there and he's going to have a hand in what happens. And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. I'm also persuaded as a result of this prophecy that many, many things happened to Egypt that were designed to change these people and to change their practices, but they probably at the time didn't realize that that was the purpose of it. For the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence. Now, all of these early civilizations had some kind of religion, some kind of God that they worshipped, or gods. Egypt had its share of idols. And what he's saying here, though, is that whenever the Lord does move this country, when he does bring about the thing that he wants to happen here, that it's going to cause the overthrow of some of these idols, and people are going to be turned away from idolatry to the true God. And the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. The heart is the innermost part of a person. And so it would be the controlling mind, the knowledge that the people had as a result of their leaders. It said it's going to melt in the midst of it. That is, it's not going to have any substance. It's not going to have any value, or any ability to carry this nation through this problem. It's going to melt. It'd be as though we got into a crisis in this nation and we need to look to our government for leadership, and suddenly the government said, well, we don't have any solution. We don't know what to do. Well, they just melt. Nobody has any answers that'll work. Verse 2, and I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight, everyone against his brother and everyone against his neighbor, city against city and kingdom against kingdom. Now, this is thought to be the time in which Egypt did have these 42 districts and in which they did war among each other. This is the time in which it could be city against city and kingdom against kingdom, because each district had its own king or own governing body. It was 42, and finally they got down to 12 kings and then finally down to one. But it was much bitter strife. It was much civil war. It was brother against brother. It was Egyptian against Egyptian, neighbor against neighbor. To bring this thing about. And as we look in ancient times upon that country and its time of civil war and strife, it makes us wonder also about what the Lord's plan was in this country during its time of civil war. So we see in history that maybe it wasn't just an accidental thing that they had civil wars, that they had kings vying for power and finally got down to one king ruling over them. Well, during this time, though, verse 3, and the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst of it, and I will destroy the counsel thereof. Now, the spirit would be much the same as saying that the heart did melt. The spirit would be the feeling of rapport, or maybe of nationality or patriotism that these people might have for their own country. while the spirit shall fail in the midst of it. It'd be difficult to feel any kind of unity, or certainly national unity, in times like this. And I will destroy the counsel thereof. That is, there will be nobody to give wise judgments or decisions. Nobody to give a plan that's going to get them out of their difficulties. The counsel of it's going to be destroyed. And you know, we think it may be difficult to have a whole nation and nobody there smart enough to lead the people. But we've seen that happen in more modern times. For example, during the time of the 30s, before World War II, you take a country that was as highly advanced as Germany was, so highly advanced in technology and in the sciences, highly educated people, highly productive, had the smartest minds and the most advanced abilities of any nation on earth. For a nation like that to be get into the hands of a dictator like Hitler and his close followers that would lead that nation into a war that would destroy millions and millions of people right there in their own back door in concentration camps. How could it happen? And I've talked to people who used to live in Nazi Germany during that time, and they themselves are still asking themselves the question, how did it happen that people like the Germans let a dictator take over like he did? Well, the councils of the government can be destroyed so that they don't have any wisdom. And we see right in our own very nation today some decisions made that are not wise at all. Even a child can make a more intelligent decision than some of our legislators make, but still it happens. And they shall seek to the idols and to the charmers and to them that have familiar spirits and to the wizards. Now these people trying to learn how to guide this nation, trying to get them out of their difficulties, look where they're going to go. They're going to go to the idols and try to get some kind of wisdom there. They're going to go to the charmers. And as I understand this word charmers, it's the only time this particular word is found in the whole Bible. And the best I can get is it means the diviners. Somebody who would have some kind of miraculous power to foresee or to foretell or to predict how to act. And to them that have familiar spirits. Now, somebody with familiar spirits, the best I can understand that is, these were people who had an acquaintance with one or more spirits. And so when they needed to call upon the wisdom and assistance of these spirits, they were familiar with them so they could call upon them and get them to aid them in decisions or in doing whatever they were doing. And so they were known as people then who had familiar spirits. And to the wizards. And the wizards were the same as the magicians. So they were seeking all of the sources of help that they knew to seek. None of them being the true and living God, of course. None of them being a wise source. But this is where they sought to get counsel. And so he just simply says that I will destroy the counsel thereof. They're not going to be able to find it. Well, we see similar things today. You know, people turn in every direction trying to find some kind of way to get some wisdom, to get some counsel. And it even creeps into the church or to those who claim to be the church. They have to go to the world to get educated enough so that they know how to run the church. They go to the world to learn how to conduct, quote, religion, end of quote. And the world doesn't have the answer for the church, nor does it have the answer for salvation. But this is the same thing that people really find themselves doing today. They like to tell tales. They like to illustrate by stories. They like to illustrate their sermons by quoting from poetry and quoting from what great men said and quoting from what the philosophers have said. And this is the way they teach lessons. But they're not teaching the Bible when they do this, because the Bible doesn't need all of these elaborate amount of outside illustrations to get the point across. The Bible's making its own points. And so they go to other places other than God for their counsel, and their counsel is destroyed. Verse 4, and the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them. saith the Lord of hosts. Now, the Lord has a hand in what's happening to them. And the Bible scholars are divided over just exactly who this cruel Lord and this fierce king is that would rule over them. It might even mean a series of cruel lords or fierce kings. But the earliest one that we can learn about from history would be this man known as Psammeticus, who reigned for 54 years. He's the one who was the victor after the 12 kings had their conflict. And he was said to have been a rather cruel and stern king. But others think that it was Nebuchadnezzar. Whenever he captured Egypt and made it a servant to Babylon. Others think that it was Cambyses, who was then the ruler of Persia, when he came in and took over Egypt. So it's a little bit difficult to know just who it was that would have been this cruel lord. But it doesn't make that much difference. All we need to know is that whoever it was and whatever it was, the Lord had a hand in it. The Lord said that I will give over the Egyptians into the hand of a cruel lord. And we think, well, this is just the way history kind of worked itself out, and not realizing that the Lord said it's the way it's going to happen. And he said it before it happened. He said it way back here before Nebuchadnezzar even captured Israel or Judah. This is a prediction. This is a prophecy about what's going to happen before it happens. Hundreds and hundreds of years before it ever happened, the Lord said this is going to happen to Egypt. Now, as he makes that opening statement, the next several verses then are spent showing some of the specific problems that would happen in Egypt as a result of these calamities. Verse 5, and the waters shall fail from the sea, and the river shall be wasted and dried up. This word sea here no doubt means the Nile River, because there are other writings which refer to it as the sea. It was a large body of water, a wide river, and it was the life of Egypt. Well, if you want to bring calamity on a nation like Egypt then, all you'd have to do then is make these waters fail. The waters from the sea make them fail. And the river shall be wasted and dried up. The river here probably is, that could be the Nile River, and it could also be the tributaries that flowed out from the Nile River as a result of the floods. But this Nile River was so important. They even knew exactly how much it had to rise every year in order for them to have a successful year. As it passed through Cairo, the river had to rise from 12 to 16 cubits in the month of August, or they would have a crop failure. Now, if it rose below 12 cubits, then it would not flood the lands, and so all the water that went by would do them no good. Water's out there, not much, but it's out there, but it's going on by and not doing us any good, and they wouldn't be able to irrigate their crops. If it rose above 16 cubits, then it would be too much of a flood, and it would have a disastrous effect the other way. So they lived on this from 12 to 16 cubit level that it would rise during the month of August, and they measured this, and still do, I suppose, to know what that river would do. Or at least they still did till recent times. Now that they have this Aswan Dam there and they're controlling this water, I don't know. I can't give you a modern interpretation of it. But the river shall be wasted and dried up. And they shall turn the rivers far away. Now, as I understand this phrase, they shall turn the rivers far away, all the reading I can do on it means that the waters are going to become putrid. And I would suppose it's because they were not refreshed by a new influx from the Nile, and so they just dry up and become stagnant or putrid waters. and the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up. The reeds and flags shall wither. Now this phrase, the brooks of defense, is also a very obscure phrase, most difficult to translate, and the Bible scholars are not agreed at all as to what it says. But it seems that some of these rivers and tributaries along the Nile were built up with dikes to the point that they were also looked upon as fortifications for the people. And so they're referred to in that way then as brooks of defense. But they'll be emptied and dried up, and the reeds and flags shall wither. Now the reeds and flags are the plants that would grow along the side of this Nile River that would produce their crops. And they had such crops as flax, which produced linen, and they had cotton, which produced the cotton fiber. And they had the papyrus that produced their paper, and they made boats out of those too. Now, verse 7, the paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither, be driven away, and be no more. Now, King James says the paper reeds, but some of the translations say the pastures by the brooks. Indicating the fertile ground that would be irrigated by these brooks, and then that by the mouth of the brooks would be the most fertile ground because it would get the most water right at the mouth just before the brook or the river emptied into the Nile River. And everything sown by the brooks shall wither and be driven away and be no more. Now we've got to understand that this country was a desert country. It had little or no rain at all. And the only way it could be a productive country was by the water from the Nile River. Well, when you affect the Nile River, you've affected everything in the nation so far as commerce goes, and even survival. The fishers also shall mourn, and all they that cast angle into the brook shall lament, and they shall spread nets upon the waters, that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. So the great fishing industry that they did have in Egypt would come to nothing. And there was a large amount of fishing there, I understand. In Numbers 11, we have a reference made, speaking of the children of Israel after they'd left Egypt and wanted to go back. Numbers 11 and 5, we remember the fish, which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away. There's nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes. The people want to go back into Egypt and get some of those good things they had. And I use that reference just simply to show that Egypt was an abundant country as long as the Nile did what it was supposed to do. They had abundance of fish. All they wanted, all kinds of fish. And there was a large industry in Egypt. Verse 9, moreover, they that work in fine flax and they that weave network shall be confounded. Now another thing that we may not realize is that during this time in ancient Egypt, the weaving industry was a well-developed and highly utilized industry. There is on record accounts of some of the cloth that was weaved back then. And they had their threads very close together. I forgot the number, how many they'd have, 42 one way and 36 another way, but it was real close. And each one of these cords, each one of these threads would have as many as 360 strands in it, all well-defined and well-woven. And they've discovered that the mummies were wrapped in flax. And by looking at the fiber of flax under the microscope, you can differentiate between flax and cotton. Flax had cords that were round and had little joints on them, whereas the cotton fibers were flat. But that cloth is still present even today that they made way back there, and like I say, the mummies were wrapped in it. Linen was a commonly used article, and you know, today as we look at cloth, we think, oh, what a modern invention, what a modern commodity to have cloth. thinking maybe that, 5,000 years ago they also had cloth that's still standing today. I doubt any of the clothes that we're wearing tonight are going to be here 5,000 years from now. Nobody's going to be able to find any traces of what we're wearing tonight in all probability. But the Egyptians had cloth that's still here today. We read some references that give us a little insight on this in Proverbs 7 and 16. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. So even in the writer of Proverbs referred to the fine linen of Egypt. Again, we find in Exodus 26 and 36, and speaking about the tabernacle, he makes a mention here of interest. And thou shalt make an hanging for the door of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen wrought with needlework. Now this fine twined linen would be the best of the linen, really, and it would be worked with needlework. Needlework, we think of it maybe as being kind of a modern thing, but they had it in the tabernacle back among the Israelites. And of course, we have to think that they acquired that skill while they were in Egypt. Well, whenever this Nile River dried up here, verse 9, moreover, they that work in fine flax and they that weave networks shall be confounded. They're not going to be able to make a living. They're not going to be able to practice their art, their trade, simply because the river didn't rise. Verse 10, and they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for fish. Now this here again, this phrase sluices and ponds for fish is another very obscure phrase, and the translators all argue about how it should be translated, and most of them say, that I've read after say, that this ponds for fish means living things. And what it really means is that all that deal in the production of living things, not just fish, but all kinds of animals and all kinds of plants, all the living things that come as a result of these ponds or these sluices that are the part of the irrigation and overflow from the Nile River. And some of the ways that they're using today to convey this water, they make these long things that are some kind of an auger device that they turn and they suck that water out of the river over into their land. And this National Geographic shows pictures of them today making this and operating them. They've been using those same things for centuries. And so they're living things. Whether it be trees or plants or animals or living things survived as a result of this river. But they should be broken into purposes thereof. That is, they're not going to be able to carry out their purpose. Their ability to make a living and their ability to practice their art is going to be broken. So you can see then that the commerce of this nation is in a very bad way, and the Lord had a part in it. He decided it was what was going to happen. So they're completely torn up from a political standpoint. They have a grievous king over them, and they've been through all kind of civil war and strife, and now then they're not able to make a living. They're not able to survive as they have been accustomed to. Verse 11, surely the princes of Zoan are fools. Now this place of Zoan was one of the capital cities, and it's thought to be, and it's pretty well thought to be, the place where Moses performed his miracles whenever he was requiring Pharaoh to let the people go. But the princes of Zoan are fools. The counsels of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. Now the wisest people Pharaoh could find, and Pharaoh is just another name for whoever the king was at that time, like we'd use the word president for this country. The counselors that he had, he says this council is brutish. It doesn't even make good sense. It's for the destruction rather than for the benefit of the people. And as I read about some of the decisions that some of our leaders make, I wonder, today even, How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? Now this, very likely, is the counselor who's saying, I am the son of the wise, I'm the son of the ancient kings, I've got all the wisdom here that has made us great, listen to me. It very likely is the counselor saying that to the king, and so the prophet says, how can you say this to the king? How can you say I'm wise, given this kind of counsel?